Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to you, and welcoming back to the show an old friend with a new job, Ralph the Talking Computer.
AI to the rescue, smarter every day. From work to play, it leads the way. Innovation, creation, it's here to stay. AI makes life better. Hip, hip, hooray.
Hip, hip, hooray, indeed. Americans could face a 70% hike in their electricity bills by 2030 unless action is taken to boost generation and transmission capacity. That is needed to satisfy an AI-driven surge in demand from data centers. That's a warning in a report from the Jack Kemp Foundation in D.C. It says billions need to be invested in extra grid capacity to keep pace with the growth in consumption by data centers. This echoes warnings from Bain and Company. Remember Bain? It was the bane of Mitt Romney's existence. That forecast energy use could outstrip supply in just a couple of years, advised U.S. utility operators to boost their annual energy generation by up to 26% in 4 years. Gartner estimated data center energy demand could balloon 160% over the next 2 years. That's a balloon big enough for the Macy's parade. A coalition of Canada's major news outlets is suing OpenAI, the maker of artificial intelligence chatbot ChatGPT, alleging the company is illegally using news articles to train its software. Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, CBC have all joined the suit, first of its kind in the country. Of course, the country is Canada. OpenAI says its models are trained on publicly available data, which means you publish it, we can steal it. The group of journalists accuses AI of ignoring safeguards like paywalls or copyright disclaimers. You know, that old stuff. Quote, OpenAI regularly breaches copyright and online terms of use by scraping large swaths of content from Canadian media. Well, they're easy scraping, come on. To help develop its products, the group is seeking punitive damages, $14,000 per article they allege was used. That's American dollars. They're also requesting an order that would force the company to share profits made from using their articles. Well, that depends on them eventually making a profit, doesn't it? As well as an injunction prohibiting OpenAI from using them in the future. This follows a similar action launched by the New York Times and other publishers last year here in the good old USA. Meanwhile, in the fusty old UK, figures from Britain's Ofcom, let's say office I guess Elon Musk would like to destroy, show sluggish adoption of AI in Britain. More than half of adults in the survey had yet to use generative AI, 38% declaring they were not interested, 35% saying they didn't need to. They didn't need to respond to the survey either, but 48% of the adults had used the technology, but only, quote, for fun, unquote. 43% had used one for work. The most popular activity was finding content. Less than one in five trusted the output. And speaking of that study by Ofcom's Online Nation report, usage of Elon Musk's X platform is declining in the UK. Total UK adult reach in a month of X continues to decline. The most significant fall in total adult use of all social media sites. Congratulations, Elon. You're going to get that valuation down to zero before it's over. Hello, welcome to the show.
babe, you don't love me. Wednesday, you ain't home. Thursday night, you got it wrapped up tight, girl. Still, I can't get you alone. Or would you let me know what you know when you know it? What you know? If you know something good, take your time,
take your time.
I don't mind. If I could, you know I surely would be good to you. I'll be good to you.
From New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you, you right there, to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. More Church of England leaders were aware of the John Smythe scandal. We've been talking about it for the last couple of weeks here. They should follow the Archbishop of Canterbury's decision to resign. That's according to just the head of the official inquiry into child abuse, is all. Professor Alexis Jay said abuse continued in the church and the cover-up of Smythe's decades of wrongdoing could not be, quote, down to one person, unquote. Takes a village to abuse a child, apparently. The Most Reverend Stephen Cottrell, who's going to inherit the duties of the Archbishop of Canterbury in a caretaker role, that'd be cute. He rejected a call to resign after being accused of ignoring 11 separate complaints, some involving leading figures in the church, including your bishops. Cottrell said he'd always taken safeguarding very seriously. The woman who led the independent inquiry said child abuse continues in the church, asked if there should be more resignations. She said, the Archbishop of Canterbury and all those who failed to take action allowed this appalling criminal behavior to continue, and for so many victims to have been damaged by it is a disgrace. Anyone who feels that should, and this is a Britishism, consider their position. Unquote. That's British for get out of town. Five members of Church of England clergy have now stood down after a review of the Smythe case accused them of having known about allegations that he, Smythe, a barrister, lawyer, abused boys at Christian camps in Zimbabwe and possibly South Africa. Smythe died 2018. Jay, the investigator, says abuse continues in the Anglican and Roman Catholic churches. Quote, I don't know why anyone would think it wasn't going on. Of course that continues because there haven't been enough protective actions taken to ensure that it should be reduced. Enough said, department. Now, just a bit of news about our friend the Atom. You know that the big question raised by some, including this broadcaster, about the whole nuke thing is, what do you do with the waste? Where do you put it? How long do you protect it? How long is it radioactive? How long is it a danger? Well, Canada's Nuclear Waste Management Organization has selected a site just north of Lake Superior for a proposed underground disposal facility for nuke waste. It's a milestone for the nuclear industry. They've been trying to find a permanent resting place for the radioactive waste, ending a search that formally began in 2010, considered 22 candidate sites. The organization had promised a consent-based process for locating the facility. That meant a demonstration of willingness to accept the waste from one municipality and one First Nation. That's an indigenous community. The township of Ignace confirmed a couple of months ago. It's willing and stands to receive $121 million, but they'll receive Canadian dollars, over the project's 175-year duration. Radiation lasts longer than that, doesn't it? Under agreement, the township said the decision has the potential to alter the future trajectory and landscape of this small community, I'll say. Meanwhile, there is an indigenous community nearby. You'll never guess what its name is. Wabigoon Lake. Wabigoon Lake. Lake Wabigoon. It's an Ojibwe Nation community. Lake Wabigoon Lake. That's where that came from. Didn't grant final approval to the project, but it announced it had held a referendum through which community members had agreed to, quote, thoroughly explore the project's feasibility. Well, that's close, isn't it? The organization running this thing told a Canadian newspaper that it had signed a hosting agreement with Wabigoon Lake First Nation, the contents of which it declined to provide or discuss. Spokesperson said, quote, it's their agreement. They can decide how much they want to make public about it. Unquote. And now, the apology of the week.
We're so sorry.
The music industry trade publication Billboard has issued an apology to Taylor Swift. They published an image of her that was taken from a Kanye West video that depicted her in bed with him. What's the problem? The music chart organization had posted a montage of Swift to celebrate her achievements as part of its Greatest Pop Stars of the 21st Century Countdown. Quote, we are deeply sorry to Taylor Swift and all of our readers and viewers that in a video celebrating Swift's achievements, we included a clip that falsely depicted her. We have removed the clip from our video. Sincerely regret the harm we caused with this error, Billboard wrote. Fans became angry when they spotted the image of Swift from West's music video for his 2016 song, Famous. In that video, West was seen in bed with a wax figurine modeled on Swift, and also a figurine of his then-wife Kim Kardashian, among other celebrities. It's a crowded bed, apparently. That's why you make a video. Song and subsequent video attracted controversy for depicting Swift naked and lyrics which said West would have sex with her. He also rapped in the song that he made that B. Oh, come on. He made that bitch famous. West claimed to have gotten the green light from Swift in a phone call. She denied it. Kardashian said at the time, Swift did approve the lyrics, later released a recording of the call between West and Swift, in which the rapper runs the I feel like me and Taylor might still have sex line past her, but there is no evidence he asked her about the I made that bitch famous line. That settles that. The apologies of the week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. This is the show, and it's time to be thinking about food, this being the week after Thanksgiving, thinking about what we're going to do with the food, hopefully something creative. But it got me thinking about an article or a newsletter that I'd recently read by a gentleman I'd become acquainted with when he was here in New Orleans. And it's rare that somebody comes to a city and radically upends part of its culinary heritage, but this guy did just that. This is a city that has long regarded bread as a thing you make po' boy sandwiches with, and normally that would be white bread, and he came in and basically showed the city a whole different way of making and enjoying bread. And his influence is still being felt to this day. Recently, as I said, he wrote a piece in the in his newsletter about wheat, grains, other things as they apply to the future of people on this planet. And I wanted to discuss that with him today. His name is Grayson Gill, creator of Bellegarde Bread here in New Orleans. And welcome to the show.
Thank you, Harry. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. So, grain.
Yeah.
Sounds mundane, rhymes, but not. I was, in the context of what you were writing about, I was thinking, well, my grain diet has been wheat and rice mainly, except I recalled recently that when I was a kid growing up in a Jewish American family, we had something called farfel.
Okay.
You ever heard of that?
Sounds like a cousin of Feifel, but
it does. No. Farfel. I looked it up because I remember eating it, but I don't know what it was. It was, they were little nuggets of egg noodle.
Okay.
That were browned.
Okay.
And were very tasty.
Okay.
But,
like a spatzel thing, kind of?
I guess. I don't know. I don't know what that
it's
is.
It's like a German egg noodle.
Right, right. Okay. I guess so. Yeah, because farfel is Yiddish yeah. from German. So, what are we doing wrong with the whole grain thing?
With the whole, well, the thing is we're doing the grain thing wholly wrong, as in we're not eating the whole grain. And that's been an issue that's been going on, not just in the U.S., but across the world for, I'd say, a good, got pretty bad by the beginning and the end of World War One, pretty much across the world. And I think an important thing to start with for people to understand is that wheat is the most grown crop in the entire world. And 1 in 5 calories across the world that people eat comes from wheat. The issue is that the refined white flour that most everybody eats, again, across the world, is more or less nutritionally void. So it's created a huge epidemic of public health problems, and it's exacerbated a lot of ecological issues that we face on the planet today.
Well, let me go backwards for a minute. First, why are we refining wheat?
Well, without getting too pedantic, historically, essentially because white flour is shelf-stable and whole grain, whole wheat flour is not.
Okay, so that's the same thing that goes through the entire food system is trying to make it shelf life.
Correct.
Yeah. I should say in your introduction, what you did here was bring an entirely different way of making and eating bread to this city. Tell me a little bit about that before we go further into the grain matter.
Yeah.
What did you do here?
I got here arrived in New Orleans on April 15th of 2009 on a Greyhound bus and just had a rucksack and a criminal record, as I tell people, not a lot of money or any plans. My best friend, his mom was from Chalmette.
Mm.
So he moved back home and I moved with him. I didn't have much else going on. And for some reason, just started baking out of our apartment on Royal Street. And that kind of snowballed and found commercial kitchen space that I was leasing with some other people. And just started baking for farmers markets and a few restaurants and cafes. And that all snowballed. And eventually I opened my own bakery in 2011 called Bellegarde Bakery. And that was the name of the first recorded bakery in French Louisiana. It was founded in, I think it was 1719 by a guy whose alias was Bellegarde. And I took that name, opened the bakery, and just was baking all by myself and delivering and doing the bookkeeping and driving and all that kind of stuff alone. And that snowballed again into eventually having a staff of 25 people.
Wow.
And I was really taken by grains. I went to vocational school for baking and I had this epiphany. It wasn't immediate, but it was gradual because we were trained on everything in baking school from wedding cakes to banana bread. And we talked about chocolate and coffee and sugar, all these things that are ingredients that have their own kind of identity and different textures and flavors and come from different places, brown sugar, white sugar, molasses, whatever. But every time we made something at school, it was always flour. And I said, but flour has got to be different too. It has to have identity in the same way that these other ingredients do. So that led me down a rabbit hole to understand where flour came from. And flour comes from mills, and mills use grain, and grain comes from the earth. And that just kind of became an inverted funnel that I just went on the tip of the iceberg and then eventually found myself milling my own flour because I couldn't find the flour that I wanted to work with. So decided to make it myself.
As I said, I became just an addict for your bread. So that's how we met. So back to whole grain and why we're not using it and the results of that.
Yeah, as a society, there was a lot of racial undertones after World War II about cleanliness and purity. The eugenics movement was huge in the 20s, not just in Europe, but in the U.S. as well, too. And the whole thing about whiteness, so purity, cleanliness. And there was also a lot of aspirational hopes on immigrants and people that came to America. So, you know, your family, my family being very recent immigrants coming from Eastern Europe, both of us. Mm-hmm. The fact that they could move to America and not just get a decent union job or, you know, own property or whatever it was, but all of a sudden buy white bread. That was a status symbol because back home, white bread wasn't a thing. That was only something for the czar in Western France for the royalty. So the fact that people could come to America and start buying white bread, even though there was an understanding that it really wasn't as good for you as this whole grain bread, there was a big aspirational and a lesser extent, a racial connotation to that in terms of purity. And the issue with that is that it's very unhealthy. So whole wheat is a whole food. It has 11 essential amino acids. It has polyunsaturated fats. It has vitamins, minerals. It's almost as healthy as a piece of sockeye salmon if treated properly. But what happens during the creation of white flour is that mills strip away about 25% of the weight of an individual wheat berry. And what's left over is a really starchy, what's called the endosperm, which is the interior of the wheat berry. And that's pure starch. So that's why you'll see on a show like, let's say, The Sopranos, you'll see all the big Italian guys, but they're big because they're eating that unrefined white flour, you know, pasta in the form of that refined white flour, and that's getting made into pasta. But it's the same with bread as well, too. So we're taking what essentially is a complete, incredibly whole, nutritious, and in my opinion, delicious food and refining it to the point where it's very sweet and therefore temporarily delicious. But it has really unhealthy effects, not just upon the people that eat it, but on the earth that grows it as well, too.
I seem to remember that you have some roots in California, do you?
Yes. Yeah.
So maybe you remember, you're probably too young to remember this, but when I was a kid, there was a place in Los Angeles called the Helms Bakery. It's now a big building that has galleries and furniture stores, but it was a bakery. And they had these little trucks, very individually designed. I don't think I've ever seen their like anywhere since. And they would come out of the bakery with bread hot from the bakery in these little trucks and drive around the neighborhood streets. And I was addicted to it as but it was white bread.
Right.
It was plain old white bread. And to add to the disgusting picture of it, my after-school snack of choice was three slices of it, not buttered, straight off the truck, washed down with a glass of prune juice.
There you go. but look at you now.
Yeah, look at me now. We all outgrow our childhood. So what do we do about this situation? What do you advocate?
I think a good analogy talking about trucks and old delivery trucks back in the day is gas mileage. Like what's the figurative gas mileage on our food? So the gas mileage on a white flour, loaf of bread or a bag of white flour, if I take 100 pounds of wheat berries, what's the individual kernels of wheat, which make flour. If I put 100 pounds of that into a mill, a flour mill, I'm only getting 75 pounds of white flour out. So 100 pounds of whole ingredient goes in and I get a 75% yield off of that. So the other 25% is more or less waste. It's industrial waste, whether it's given to hog farms or the cereal industry or wherever it goes somewhere else. But essentially we're overgrowing and overconsuming to make up that differential of that 25%.
Right.
Whereas my argument and my background and my passion comes from saying, what if we just ate the whole animal? From nose to tail, what if we just ate the whole wheat berry? And if we put 100 pounds of wheat berries, wheat kernels in the mill and got 100 pounds of whole wheat flour out, the ecological consequences would be a lot greater, less inputs on infrastructure, transportation, fertilizers, gas, tractors, diesel, et cetera, but also the cost nutritionally to the people that ate that whole grain flour, that whole wheat flour, would be tremendous. I think a big thing that, in my opinion, when it comes to the American hospital system and American healthcare, in my opinion, what we're treating in our hospitals is the American diet. Whether that's prostate cancer, heart disease, diabetes, these are all, if you take cigarettes out of the equation, these are all health-related factors that we're dealing with. So essentially, in my opinion, if we could eat more whole foods, we could have a preventative medicine system that, as opposed to treating the American diet 20, 30 years from now, we could be more preventative and eat foods the way that they were grown and the way that they were intended to be consumed, which is whole. Mm-hmm. Nobody is going to tell you, Harry, I've got this beautiful Wagyu cattle farm. Every night we watch Spinal Tap together. I massage their hooves. I have fleece pajamas I put them in, and the steak is $100. But before selling you that steak, I cut out all the fat because I don't want you to have to eat the fat. We eat whole foods across the board. We eat fat on steak. Mm-hmm. Nobody cuts the outside of the oyster away and discards that. Typically, people are going to eat the skin on a carrot or the skin on a potato.
No, I skin my carrots.
You skin your carrots. Well, there's still time to live. But for the most part, we have a culture that's been acculturated to trying to eat the whole animal. Mm-hmm. But with wheat, we're not eating the whole animal. And that's where the health effects and to the individual and the ecological effects come in. Because again, we're growing more than we need to. Because we're not eating.
And so we're using way more inputs than we need.
Exactly.
So I'm not speaking for myself in this case, because as I say, I'm an addict of what you've brought to town and what is still being baked here. But when I think the average person hears whole wheat, mm-hmm. they think something dark and sort of dark tasting. Yeah. As opposed to the word you used earlier, sweetness of white bread. But what your techniques have brought out is this whole world of flavor that is not dark or grim or scary. I guess one of my epiphanies bread-wise was when I first went to France and I was up at Chateau Neuf de Pop for an afternoon and I bought a baguette. And realized, oh, you don't need butter on these. Mm. It's a whole different thing.
Yeah, it's not a napkin anymore for flavors. And I feel like we use white flour as a napkin to saturate with butter, with jam, with whether it's, if it's pizza, a bunch of sauce, a bunch of, you know, a bunch of cheese, a bunch of toppings. But mm-hmm. for me, flour is an ingredient. It should be ingredient. It should be an ingredient included in the dialogue of the cuisine or the dialogue of the bread or the pizza or whatever it is. Because at the end of the day, pizza is just a dough mm-hmm. and bread is just bread. So if you have to kind of inundate it with makeup, with a bunch of foundation and, you know, rouge and eyeliner, then what's wrong with the foundation of it? So for me, I like to say that we're trying to repatriate the integrity and flavor of whole grains and treat flour as an ingredient, not so much as a product anymore.
And we've been talking about wheat up to now, but another thing that you brought up in your newsletter was the number of grains that we're not eating.
Yeah, it's across the board. I mean, the refinement of grains, not just wheat, is across the board with rice, corn, millet, sorghum, rye. Basically, every cuisine across the world, from Africa to East Asia to Europe to the U.S., is founded on a whole grain. But like I said, 100, 150 years ago, we made a shift from whole grains to refined grains, and that's had serious consequences across the board, whether it's Mesoamerica with refined corn products and corn that's not nixtamalized, it's not treated with cow and therefore made super nutritious, or whether it's polished white rice in East Asia. We've lost out the integrity that whole foods bring, not just to our cultures, but to our diets as well, too. So no grains are immune from what's been going on the past 150 years.
How do we cross this barrier of, on the one hand, better nutrition, and on the other, longer shelf life?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it starts again, I think fundamentally with the ingredient having integrity and hopefully with the people eating it having, I don't like that word awareness, but I am a millennial, so for lack of a better word, awareness and education of the ecological costs of, you know, how it does to what it does to our planet to eat cheaply. Another thing that I'm really aware of is the difference between value and cost. So I know there's a lot of socioeconomic assumptions and certain demographics that we're talking about, you and I being able to financially afford a $5 or $10 loaf of bread, whereas other people or other families or other cultures can't, they can't look at a loaf of bread that costs $5 or $10.
Right.
So I hate to say it, but in a lot of ways, it's the government's prerogative to stop subsidizing cheap food and hopefully start subsidizing more healthy food. I think there's also a lot of room for market innovation and making whole foods more accessible financially to people. So the cost side is one part of the equation, but to me, I'm almost more concerned with the value side of the equation. And that goes back to what I said about treating the American diet in the American healthcare system. So we can say that, yes, this loaf of bread costs more money, but the value to the people eating it, to the people making it, and to the earth growing it is a lot greater than the value of cheaper food, because we're essentially subsidizing the American diet with Medicare and all these other things now. So my argument would be, if we could take a fraction of that money that's dedicated to reacting against the American diet and respond to the American diet now with healthier, you know, whole foods, local or regional foods, we would be saving money as a society. And that keeps the moralizing out of it, because at the end of the day, it's all about money. But yeah, also because it's food, it's about deliciousness. So yeah, as you brought up a few minutes ago, whole grain foods are a lot more delicious than that plain white flour bread or baguette or tortilla or whatever it is.
The problem with that is, of course, that the large ultimate costs are down in the future.
Yeah.
And the immediate costs are in the present.
Right.
And to get that equation solved is the problem, right?
Yeah, it's a third rail of politics, like Social Security. It's my generation asking you and my parents' generation to say, can we reorient, you know, money or savings that you've put into things into something different for my family and my kids now? So yeah, but I feel like we spend so much money on food and food waste, and we spend so much money treating the American diet. If we really just repatriated, let's say, 10 cents of every dollar spent on American healthcare, which is in the trillions of dollars annually, to subsidizing local mills, subsidizing organic grain research, subsidizing bakers that are using X amount of whole grains, not handouts, but subsidizing a healthier diet, I think that would provide a greater value to the earth and to society as a whole. And one thing that I think I believe is really important is the fact that all cuisines across the world were founded on whole grains. So in 13th century...
That's an economic fact, right? Those were the cheapest sources of
nutrition. When you look at a recipe these days for, let's say, making pasta at home, and it calls for 13 egg yolks and 8 quarts of water to boil the pasta in, I'm not Italian, but I've done my reading, and Italy was not a rich country. So 800 years ago, whoever Giuseppe's grandma that invented gnocchi, she didn't have a bunch of egg yolks lying around to dump into pasta. If anything, maybe she had one egg. And she also didn't have white flour. So all the foundational ingredients in our cuisines are whole grain flours. And again, whole grains as well. So whole grain rice, whole grain corn, whole grain flours as well too. So pasta, pastry, bread, these European and American cuisines were founded on the backbone of whole grain flours. And it's only very recently that that ingredient shifted from whole grain fresh flour to this refined white flour. So I tell students in all the classes I teach that we're not trying to reinvent the wheel right now. We're kind of going through a renaissance. Because Michelangelo wasn't inventing David. He was just doing what he could have seen in Athens, I guess, what was that, 1600 years before he sculpted David. It wasn't about a brand new vision that he had. He was doing something that had already been done, and was bringing that back. And that's what I think that we're facing right now and what we need to do. So in a way, I find that comforting because it's not like you have to solve the riddle. You just kind of have to look backwards in order to move forward.
I seem to recall that in that piece, you also made a case for broadening the variety of grains that are available in this culture and this diet. Tell me about a little bit about that.
Yeah, wheat, like any other ingredient, I mean, there's thousands of varieties. So it's not just like your heirloom tomato or your Roma tomato at the store. It's not just like white wine or, you know, I spent time this summer in Eastern Europe and I was talking to people about, before the wall fell, cheese was on the shelf, or milk. I mean, it was these, you know, unbranded, just general products.
Generic.
Yeah. Soap. So for better or for worse, but yeah. Wheat has varietals just like wine does. So there's not just this wheat and that wheat. There's red wheats and there's soft wheats and there's hard wheats and there's white wheats and there's purple wheats and yellow wheats and blue wheats. And there's all sorts of different wheats. So as opposed to confusing the ingredient of flour with the varietal, it's a fun thing to work on as a baker and also as a farmer to say that all of a sudden I have a Chardonnay or I have a Sauvignon or I have a Merlot or I have a Tempranillo. And whatever varietal of that wheat that I'm growing is going to express the local area in which it was grown. So you're one of the most famous wheats is called Turkey Red. That is originally from Turkey, but came out of Odessa in the Ukraine. So growing Turkey Red in Manitoba versus Ojai, California versus Sheffield, England, it's going to have different expressions,
totally different
flavor, nutrition, nuance. And to me, that's unbelievably fun because it's creative and because food for me is a method of self-expression. And if we're all working with the same dead, inert white flour, then the bread that I make in Malaysia is no different than the bread that you're going to be making in Italy. And to me, that's boring because if it's a matter of self-expression, which it is, I would want to use the ingredients that mean the most to my culture, my area, my background, my village, or my bakery, as opposed to working with the same stock that you have in Santa Monica. You know, to me, there's not just no integrity there, but there's no fun. There's no fun
variety.
Or creativity. There's no variety.
You know, you remind me of a totally different food, which I just have been reading about recently, that of all the kinds of bananas in the world, there's one
Cavendish
that's grown commercially,
right?
And it's going to die off because there's a disease affecting it that is apparently incurable,
right?
But that has been a common trait of, to use a strange phrase, food progress over the years, is the commercializing and standardizing of one breed of a food as opposed to the endless variety that is out there.
Yeah. The risk to genetic diversity is huge. And that's what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Not just with the banana, but avocado. I think there's 3 or 4 types grown commercially, and the Haas is the overwhelming varietal. But the risk to that, to pest, to disease, to whatever, is tremendous. So we're hedging our bets. We're investing all in this one stock, but we're neglecting the penny stocks. And the risk of that is genetic diversity. And I think we saw that spelled out really well with COVID, where we had this massive food system. It just needed a few fingers to kind of press it over. And everybody saw we're still dealing with the results of inflated prices because of COVID, because we don't have a diverse food supply system, nor do we have enough genetic diversity within what we grow to absorb shockwaves, which are going to probably, unfortunately, continue to happen more and more in this world.
Yeah. But the other thing is that I would suggest is that when we standardize and limit the genetic diversity of whatever kind of food we're talking about, we're also ipso facto increasing the need for all the chemicals and pesticides and things to prevent the genetic die-off of this now very isolated breed.
Exactly. It becomes more and more fragile. So we're stabilizing it with the steroids of fertilizers, fungicides, all of these things to keep the sick patient, the sick varietal alive, because we're stressing it so much, exactly to your point. So the fragility, it just becomes this catch-22 of dumping more expensive inputs to mitigate the risk. And in my opinion, we can mitigate the risk by not risking anything at all, but by having more genetic diversity, which is better, quote unquote, for the planet, but it's really better for all of us because, mm-hmm. you know, the past 4 years, the price of food's gone up 21%. So if we had more genetic diversity on the farm and in the supermarket, the cost of food, I would say reasonably, is going to settle down. But to your point, we become addicted to this consistency, to the food progress of more and more, but the cost of more and more consistency and more and more availability is this risk, again, of putting more and more into that, more fertilizer, more chemical, more irrigation to make sure that that single monolithic variety mm-hmm. is okay. So yeah, I'm more of a pantheist. You know, I believe in multiple gods as opposed to just the one. But monotheism and monoculture on the farm, it's a little bit risky.
Yeah. No, I mean, the stuff I've been reading is that there's a frantic search in food science now for the next commercial banana, because Cavendish is like got 5 year lifespan left, and that's about it.
And the Cavendish family in the UK, are they? What are they going to do without the royalties? Monsieur Cavendish,
Lord Cavendish,
excuse me. Yeah.
So, should we be eating more millet?
Depending where you are, depending on your stomach and what you need. But that's that's a great question. I think that we could be eating more things that are non-traditional flour in our breads. And what comes to mind are beans, because beans fix nitrogen. They're full of fiber, a lot of minerals and vitamins. And if we could do something, there's something that bakers are working on called a field blend. So that's essentially taking kind of like a clutch of whatever is grown in that patch. And as opposed to segregating it on the combine, milling it all together at the mill, and that's a field blend of different flours that you're working with. So there's more genetic diversity in there, there's more flavor, there's more vitamins, more nutrition, and the beans and the rye, whatever else was in that blend, is doing good things to that patch of soil. So whether it's increasing the microbiology or having the rootstock grow deeper or fixing nitrogen in the case of beans, we're diversifying what's grown on the farm, but also diversifying what we're consuming as well too. So things like millet, beans, sorghum, there's something called the climate change blend, which is essentially a bunch of different varietals of wheat kind of thrown together in the field. And it's kind of a race, like whatever variety does better is the one that grows the tallest, mm-hmm. but the farmer doesn't discriminate at the harvest. They cut the whole thing down and that all gets milled and baked together. So again, we're kind of ensuring that genetic diversity as opposed to just growing all of our Chardonnay in this one area. All of a sudden we're saying, you know what, let's hedge our bets with 10 different varieties
in
the same patch.
You used a word that growing up in LA, I used to hear the farm report daily at noon and the word sorghum would appear often. That's mainly animal feed, right?
In Africa, it's a huge grain.
Really?
It's really delicious. And also in the South, in the U.S. South, there's a huge but kind of dying industry and history of sorghum molasses.
Ah.
So that's really delicious. There's still a few producers around that you can get sorghum molasses from, but it's a delicious grain. But typically it is for animal feed. But I don't know anyone that hasn't given something to an animal that hasn't tried it first, meaning a farmer, you know?
Yeah.
But most of the things that animals eat, you know, we eat as well in different forms.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, sorghum is a neglected kind of minor grain along with millet that we could be eating and that we used to eat in small amounts to round out the diet and to round out that loaf of bread as well too.
Hmm. Grayson Gill, so fascinating to talk with you about all that stuff. Almost as fascinating as eating your bread.
Thank you.
Thanks for spending a little time with us
today.
Thanks,
Harry. Appreciate it.
concerned with gain. As the seasons come and go, greater grows the pain. And far too many feeling the strain. Oh, when will there be a harvest for the world?
And ladies and gentlemen, we're entering real winter now, which makes it even more appropriate to discuss crypto winter, which continues. DEX, D-E-X-X, a meme coin trading terminal, is at the center of a major security breach. It has left users grappling with significant losses, you know. Reports indicate unauthorized token transfers drained $16 million+ in user funds, according to CoinEdition.com. Tokens from Ban and Loose, just those are the names of the tokens, suffered the most substantial losses. The DEX team acknowledged the issue via a public statement, assuring users the situation doesn't involve a rug pull. No rug involved. No rugs, m'lady. They have enlisted professional security audit teams to identify and resolve the vulnerability. The team also noted updates on the progress will be communicated through in-app notifications and social media platforms. CertiK, the leading blockchain security auditor, confirmed receiving help requests from affected users. The investigation revealed the core issue was improper private key management, which led to the exposure of DEX's official private key. You remember Private Key? He was in the service for... Poulter Finance, a decentralized non-custodial lending and borrowing platform, paused its operations and involved law enforcement after a hack drained its total value locked of $12 million. These are, I guess, real dollars that they're losing? Or are they just... This is from Cointelegraph. Poulter Finance paused its platform a week or so ago after identifying an exploit, notified investors. The protocol investigated the stolen funds, traced them to wallets on the crypto exchange Binance. According to the web security team, 10 Armor, the Poulter Finance protocol lost $12 million because of a faulty Oracle price-related flash loan attack on its newly launched Spooky Swap Boo Market. Don't these names reassure you at all? Don't they make... Poulter has yet to affirm the nature of the attack. In the meantime, Poulter Finance reached out to the hacker via an online on-chain message offering scope for negotiation and impunity. That's what we all want, isn't it? And decentralized science platform Pump Science apologized to its users after its private key was leaked on GitHub, allowing a known attacker to create fraudulent tokens, unlike those real ones, using its pump.fun profile. This all sounds so real, doesn't it? Pump.fun. Come on, let's take a bath in crypto. Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. Back next week, same time, over these same radio stations, on your audio device of choice whenever you want it. The email address for this program, chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts. Christmas is coming and then going. And the playlist of the music heard here on, as well as all sorts of stuff to watch and listen to and read, all at harryshearer.com. I've moved over to Blue Sky at Harry Shearer, and I have a kind of a remain at Twitter for a while at The Harry Shearer. This show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. So long from the Crescent City.